Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hello, friends, and welcome to this edition of the Coming In for a Landing podcast on the Liberty Ballers Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Hudrick, and we had to do another episode this week. Of course, we had Doris Burke on the other day, who was excellent, fantastic, breaking down the series so far and going forward. She will have the call for Game 6 Thursday night on ESPN, so look forward to that. Today, I have another very special guest, my good friend and a former colleague from NBC Sports Philadelphia, their Sixers insider, and that is the great Noah Levick. Noah, thank you so much for coming on, man. I appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, not in the same very special category as Doris Burke, you know, well, in my personal opinion, but nevertheless.
So few are. No, that's not an indictment on you. That's just doesn't mean that you're not. You're obviously a very special guest as well. But yeah, it's Doris Burke. I mean, that's like some mountaintop stuff. That's exactly. Some good stuff.
To have Doris. Comparisons are not valid there. But yeah, thank you for coming on. And yeah, we've got a big one coming up. So exciting times in the Sixers world.
Yeah. And you were there in Boston for Game 5. Wild one. Wild in the sense that not that really anything particularly wild in the game happened, just wild that this is a Philadelphia 76ers team that we all know has struggled at this time of year in the second round. Game 5s, I think. You know, when the series 2-2, I can't remember the exact stat, but it had been a very, very long time since they had won a game 5 tied 2-2. So a little bit of what's that?
First time. Yeah, literally the first
time. It was literally the first time. Literally the first time. So, yeah. So there you go. Such a long time that it's never happened. But yeah, I mean, so, you know, they kind of found themselves in sort of unfamiliar territory with basically a wire-to-wire win and pretty comfortable for the most part. There was never a point for me where I felt like, oh, here we go. Like this is where it happens. This is where they kind of unravel. I never felt that. I mean, there was a moment or two where maybe the Celtics went on a little bit of a run and got momentum, but it felt like every time the Sixers had an answer. And it also felt like the crowd just never got into it. Just, they never had like an opportunity to get into it. You were there. So just kind of, lay it out for me. Describe the scene and just the overall vibe and feel of the game as a whole.
Yeah, I think what stood out to me is essentially every controllable in that game, the Sixers were damn near perfect. Of course, every single shot doesn't always go in. And I think Joel Embiid was correct afterward to say, I missed some that I usually make. He got a lot of good mid-range looks. And Doc Rivers said before the game, it's going to boil down to make or miss a lot of the time. But I think if you remove that from the equation, the Sixers were just obviously superior across the board. I think they got the first 4 offensive rebounds of the game. Tobias Harris got 9 rebounds in the first half. And just consistently now with this team, you see the little speed bumps don't seem like very big obstacles at all. So Harris getting in foul trouble for a second straight game. You know, Boston having those mini spurts, Tatum, you know, hitting some tough shots in the second half. It never really mattered very much. I think it was also noticeable that the team has responded awfully well to Doc Rivers' timeouts this series. So I think Boston cut it to 22-19. The Sixers get an ATO that eventually leads to a Maxi Embiid dribble handoff. Maxi zooms in for a layup. And then boom, end of the first quarter, you know, he's firing up threes the way the Sixers love to see, and he's knocking all of them down. So I think at that point, it felt like Boston was in a shaky spot. And then it's okay, what's going to happen in these Embiid-less minutes? Generally, that's not been a bad answer in terms of Paul Reed's role, but you look out there and you see Daniel House Jr. And the Sixers start the second quarter with a 7-0 run. All of a sudden, the lead's 14 points. You start to hear the boos from the home crowd that expects much better than this from the defending Eastern Conference champions. And at that point, the game was over. Yes, the Sixers have not always been awesome this year at holding leads. There's been quite a few games where they've had a significant lead, then they've lost it, and then they've eventually – yeah, that was the blueprint, right, for quite a few Sixers wins this year. But for me, once that lead expanded to 14 points because of the Embiid-less lineup and with the way Jason Tatum was playing and just the Celtics' overall approach and body language, I didn't think the Celtics were going to win that game. And it was, I think, stunning for those fans who already had one shocking loss in this series when James Harden went off for 45 points in game one. This was a different kind of shocker. And the Sixers, who knows if they're capable of duplicating this, but it didn't feel fluky because it wasn't just, oh, they hit a million tough shots and players had career best nights or anything along those lines. I think for the most part, everyone executed their jobs at a high level. The focus was fantastic collectively, and they played a great game. And Boston, in contrast, did a lot of stuff that is open for criticism in terms of the strategy and, in terms of the performances from their best players. In contrast, I think the Sixers got exactly what they wanted from everyone who took the court. So can't get much better than that. And it leaves them, on the verge of doing something special here if we're talking about, special accomplishments. Yeah.
It's funny because the way you describe how the Celtics played, I feel like this is how we've looked at the Sixers in previous years in the playoffs, right? Like the bad body language, getting down and kind of letting it snowball and not kind of, overcoming it and not overcoming the little things. And now it's completely flipped. The Sixers are the team who doesn't let that happen. They're the team that doesn't, when guys hit tough shots or when things don't go their way, they don't turtle up. I mean, they keep playing. And to see Boston do that, like you mentioned too, like a team that's, they were in the Eastern Conference, they were in the finals last year, they're Eastern Conference champs, and argument to be made, they got better. With the addition of Malcolm Brogdon, with Derek White, having more run here and having more familiarity with Robert Williams, perhaps being healthier now than he was at this time last year. A lot of reasons to believe the Celtics team was actually better. I think a big thing was the Sixers, and you kind of touched on is kind of, it felt like they were the aggressor all night. It felt like they were setting the pace. They were setting the tone all night. And the Celtics were kind of back on their heels, which, again, for Sixers fans, that's a very refreshing change of pace, I would imagine. I'll say the one thing I've noticed about the Celtics, and this isn't like, they're a great team. They won 57 games. They were they had the second best record of the NBA for a reason. They're still a great team. Their half court offense has really not been impressive at all. And I know that was a point of emphasis for the Sixers. And I know everyone, like the first 10 seconds, like they're one of the best teams in the NBA, the first 10 seconds of the shot clock. I would like to know where they rank the next 14 seconds of the shot clock, because it just feels like the Sixers in the half court have really had outside of maybe the first half of game one, they've really had their number in the half court. And Joel Embiid, I know, is a big part of that. His rim protection has been otherworldly, but what have you seen in that regard? How do you think the Sixers have been able to have so much success in the half court defensively?
Yeah, I mean, from where I'm sitting, perhaps the team's half court defense has been underrated throughout the season. And
that's also fair.
I think just the vast majority of games where they are poor defensively, a lot of that has been transition. And they nipped that problem in the bud, I think, rather well. It was an historically abysmal start. Like literally, if looking at the numbers of how many points their opponents were adding through transition play over the first five games. And then, as George Niang tells it, there was one of these honest, frank conversations initiated by Doc Rivers in which he basically said, you don't get back on defense, there's a good chance you're not going to be on the court. And they've not been bad at all in terms of their transition defense since that point. Sure, there are occasional instances where they slip up and guys get lazy about, you know, doing what's necessary and, you know, picking up the ball. There's memorable instances of that in the regular season against the Boston Celtics. Looking back, you know, at the film before this series, I thought it was funny. Just one play where Al Horford gets a defensive rebound, just dribbles down the heart of the court, and no one guards him, so he takes a three. So yeah, the Sixers in transition need to be sturdy. They understand that. And then in the half court, like any defense that has Joel Embiid back there is probably not going to be very bad. I think game one, there was probably some unsustainably hot shooting on Boston's end. And then in contrast, of course, last night, the Celtics will tell themselves that they missed a bunch of good looks and that Al Horford's not going to shoot 0-for-7 again. But I do
he's
think
low 30% for this, for the series. I think he's low 30%.
And 0-for-7 is going to do that. And yeah, he was like a 45% 3-point shooter during the regular season. Yeah. But the team, I think, has also become better at those little things that PJ Tucker harps on. So we heard a bunch early in the year, guys saying the communication just isn't good enough. And there are too many times where we're not on the same page about a coverage, or we're too late to, you know, have the low man over there helping. And that stood out to me last night, that not only was there extraordinary effort with the defensive rotations and, you know, trying to be a cohesive unit, but they actually were. Like, there weren't really noticeable plays where, you know, guys both went to, you know, guard the same man, and the scrambling was just really sharp and not a flawless defensive effort, but it feels legit to me that as long as the Sixers keep the game in the half court, they're not going to have dramatic problems on defense. And part of that's also Tyrese Maxey raising his game on that end of the court and taking, I think, personal accountability that he can't be a weak spot for this team. They need him to play a lot of minutes. And in order for that to happen, he has to be sturdy, you know, on that end of the ball. I also think, you know, probably worth pointing out, the Sixers had zero turnovers in the first nearly 17 minutes. And that does feel like an especially important part of the formula for this team. Don't turn the ball over, leave the transition defense less vulnerable to problems, and they're usually going to be in a nice spot overall, I think.
And I believe they only had 7 turnovers in all of game 4, which is a game that went to overtime, and they only had, so yeah, I mean, I think it's where Boston thrives too, because like you said, I mean, that feeds the transition game, and like, what Boston was really good at during the regular season. I mean, they were the second rated defense in the NBA, and they turned people over, and that's what they did. They turned defense into offense. And when you're limiting those opportunities by A, not turning the ball over, and then B, by getting back on defense and having your defense set, it's obviously huge. And yeah, I'm glad you pointed out Tyrese Maxey, because I agree. I mean, you know, the switches on Tatum and Brown, I mean, they just haven't been able to really just, you know, take advantage of him, or the help, as you pointed, the help's been really good in those moments where maybe he does, where, you know, a Tatum or a Brown kind of uses their strength and their size to back him down and get into a favorable position. You see the help defense really, you know, doing its job, or you see Joel Embiid just erasing everything at the rim. So yeah, I think that's a great assessment of where they are with the half court. And it stems from getting back, stopping the transition, and then it allows them to set their half court defense, which has been, I think you're correct in saying it's probably been a little underrated, because when they've been right, when they've been fully healthy, when Joel Embiid has been fully engaged, their half court defense was excellent during the regular season. And I think that's just showing up here on the bigger stage. You brought up Paul Reed and you know, the minutes, and how, you know, they not only did they not lose the Paul Reed minutes in the first half, they actually won them. They built onto the lead. It's just so wild to me that we've gone from a point where it felt like every year in the Joel Embiid era, it was the backup center was more often than not, the biggest topic of conversation as far as what this team needs, what this team is lacking. And in this playoff run, Paul Reed has pretty much erased that, right? I mean, it's been no one is on Twitter screaming about the backup center. It's not the topic of conversation. Like, the only reason I'm bringing it up is because it's like not a topic. But just what have you seen from Paul Reed? Where do you think are kind of his biggest areas of growth that have kind of allowed him to just play the game, like simplify his game, be that role player, and just, you know, and give the Sixers positive minutes when Joel Embiid isn't on the floor?
Yeah, I guess for me, the framework with Paul Reed is like predictability versus unpredictability and that whole continuum. So, you know, in the G League, everyone raved, you know, positively about the chaos that was inherent to his game. And it was almost unavoidable. Like, if he was on the court, every single play, he was going to be in the middle of it. And that's great to have that, you know, nose for the ball and for the opponent to not always know what's going to hit them, you know, whether it's some quirky, you know, spin move or Euro step or flying, you know, with a great defensive rotation or whatever. But some of those instincts, I think, if you're an NBA backup center, are not ideal. And the Sixers emphasized that with him heading into this season. And I think you started to hear him grasping that. So I think back to, you know, training camp preseason, and he's learning some of the nuances of how to run DHOs from Montrezl Harrell and how to be effective as a roller in tandem with James Harden. And he's starting to think about it through that lens of, my teammates need to know what to expect from me. So I think often with Paul Reed, people have thought of it as like avoiding mistakes and being dependable and, you know, playing the part of a veteran so that your coach has trust in you. But for me, I think it's neat to recognize him finding the right middle ground for him between predictability and unpredictability. And I think that is a fantastic aspect of his development. I think if we're being honest too, a lot of it's just, does James Harden trust you on the court? So James Harden plays a key role in who shares the floor with him. And there's been a dialogue throughout this year with Doc Rivers about what the ideal lineups are when Embiid is off the court. And initially, you know, according to Doc Rivers, Harden had a significant preference for Montrezl Harrell, who he knew well and whose tendencies he understood. And of course, Harrell brings a lot of good stuff to the table offensively. But I think more and more, Reed has shown James Harden that I am beginning to take the feedback that you give me on when you want me setting screens, how you want me to space the floor. And slowly but surely, that trust has been gained with, you know, the most important player for Paul Reed to gain that trust from. And I think obviously the Doc Rivers side of it is big and draws a lot of scrutiny. Rivers, I think, still has some skepticism that Reed is capable of, you know, executing multiple defensive coverages and processing complicated information, because he has made mistakes in the past when the Sixers have tried to vary their schemes and that sort of thing. But hey, the more reps that you get in high-stakes situations and thrive in them, inevitably the more the people in charge are going to feel pretty good about you handling those well. So definitely Paul Reed is not a perfect player, but I think he's begun to think more this year about, what kind of player am I? What kind of player does the team want me to be? And like, most importantly for him, that trust factor, how can I gain trust? And you're not going to gain trust if you're unpredictable 100% of the time, even if that's really fun and effective on occasion.
It is fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of, you know, my favorite plays to watch in person this year was that wild one against the Nets, where he's just
yes.
unexpectedly juking guys out of their shoes. And that sort of wild play is always on the table with him, but I think he gets now that that's cool and you don't need to eliminate that entirely, but be dependable, be predictable with offensive rebounding, solid screen setting, knowing what to do defensively. Something else, if we're just talking strictly like this time last year, that I've noticed is he doesn't like bite on pump fakes anymore. I mean, foul trouble was a huge concern
yes.
in that Miami series, to the point that Doc Rivers cited it as a reason he leaned toward DeAndre Jordan when Embiid was out those first two games. And I remember going through the film of that Heat series, and Jimmy Butler is especially savvy, but
sure.
there were so many plays where he was in good defensive position and he's leaving his feet as a guy takes a mid-range shot, and he's just taken that out of his game entirely. And that's, I think, pretty significant progress in an important area. So he has developed quite nicely here and I think has risen to the occasion time after time in the playoffs, which is cool. I think he's never lacked self-belief, and he's
sure.
He's a gamer, right? Like, he's always
out the mud now. Yeah.
He's out the mud. He's always going to think that like any challenge, he's going to crush it. But the self-assessment side of it and the growing maturity that has been helpful in complementing, those core traits that make Paul Reed who he is.
I remember the practices during the week of the play-in before the Nets series started. And Doc had that perhaps too honest answer. I think, was it you? I think you might have asked one of the questions, right? Where he kind of went on about like what you're talking about with the coverage is and how he can only trust him to play one coverage and all that. And I just remember thinking, like, man, he's going to pull the plug on this like pretty quick. Like, I think Paul's going to have a real short leash. But I give Doc a lot of credit because there were like, maybe a couple times where maybe he could have done that. Maybe not even. I mean, maybe really one. The only time I could really think of is maybe game four when he really wasn't very good in the first half of game four against the Nets. And maybe he could have thought about doing something different, but he stuck with him. Paul Reed rewarded that and played great. That might have been his best stretch as an NBA player. He was excellent.
I think game one against Boston, I mean, Paul Reed played almost all the minutes. I mean, he played like a Joel Embiid load in that game.
Right.
And he was not perfect by any means, but he's in there as the Sixers center down the stretch, and he's the guy knocking down the clutch cool free throws.
Yeah,
so,
four straight. And he came up with a big defensive play as well on the Celtics' real last offensive possession that they were still in the game. And like, really, I mean, Doc has a very viable option in PJ Tucker at the five, and it hasn't been needed. That's still kind of in Doc's back pocket if he ever wants to use it. But Paul Reed has been so effective that it hasn't been necessary. I know we've talked before about how effective PJ was at the five for the Heat last year, and right now, I mean, it's worked out better that Paul has really stepped up and taken that. It's only what I think he played maybe 6 minutes, I think, in game five, but like, hey, those 6 minutes have been positive, and that's a great thing. And if they can, maybe play him an extra minute or two and buy Joel Embiid a little bit more time, that might not be a bad thing either. To keep him fresher for the fourth quarter. But I'm definitely want to get into Joel Embiid too a little bit. But I first want to touch on Daniel House, and it's crazy with him because when they signed him in the offseason and got tampering charges for it, I think we all looked at it as like, okay, like this is the guy now who, with respect to Matisse Thybulle, like this is the guy who can give them balance, who can be, he can be a good defender. He can lock down, some really good perimeter players, but also he's not a minus on the other end. He can hit a three. He's really good in transition. He's athletic. As I know you pointed out, he's a pretty good connective passer. Knows where to go with the ball. Not a playmaker of the ilk of a point guard or like a James Harden, but a solid sound passer, made a really nice play to Tyrese Maxey for a big three at a key spot in game five. But I think when he was signed, we all kind of had this vision like, okay, like this is the guy. And then really he just got off to such a bad start and just really found himself out of the rotation. And Doc didn't go back to him for a while. But I give Doc Rivers credit for two things. One, kind of, as he would say, he kept him alive. You know, he played him down the stretch and let him get some time when they had that brutal schedule in March and April. He let him get some minutes and let him get some run and kind of got him reacclimated and got him back into things. And I thought Al gave him some good minutes in that regard. I thought he played some, you know, he had some key moments during that stretch. And then for Doc to kind of trust his gut and go with him in that spot, it's a hell of a gut decision to make, and he made it, and it was so effective because House was so good. And I think too, Noah, like the one thing I believe is like some people wondered like, oh, well, why didn't you go to House sooner? You know, when McDaniels was struggling or, you know, Niang wasn't great in games 1 and 2, but he obviously was decent in 3, 4, 5, but why didn't you go to House sooner? And I kind of think House not playing, like he looked faster than everybody. Like, right. Like he looked fresh. He looked, and I get he's already a fast, athletic, energetic player, but I thought it was like he was like in hyperspeed compared to the kind of everyone else in the series who's kind of been fighting and beating each other up. So I guess just what did you see from House? And do you think that perhaps, you know, him kind of coming in as a super fresh player maybe was to his advantage against some guys who have played a lot of tough minutes already in the playoffs?
He was great. It just felt very, very fitting for me. I think when they signed him, what stood out to me is like any situation you roll the ball out there, this guy, he doesn't need to know the plays. Sometimes he might not know the plays. Right. And he's going to find a way to help your team. And part of that's athleticism, but like James Harden was very complimentary also of his basketball IQ when his instincts and his sense for reading situations and knowing how to play off star talent. So all of that, when they signed him, popped to me as encouraging. And last night was the ultimate situation where Doc Rivers didn't give him any sort of heads up. And yeah, his number was called and he basically said, all right, it's go time. It's Daniel House time.
I love that quote. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the mentality. I think, you know, that's pretty consistent from him. So he was excellent. I think, yeah, the 10 points are nice, but the defense on Brogdon was also quite valuable. Doc Rivers, after multiple games, the Sixers have lost to the Celtics this year, has been like, man, Brogdon, you know, crushed us. And if we, you know, essentially didn't concede 20 points to a guy off the bench, we probably would have won this game. Well, I think Brogdon was 3 for 9 last night. And, you know, the couple minutes House gave them on Brogdon were damn solid. Didn't commit any unwise fouls, solid, tight defense on the ball, and contributed to the Sixers having that surge of energy early in the second quarter, while the Celtics, in contrast, began to look rather deflated and, you know, fell into this sizable hole. So I think it's hard for me to have excessive praise for what Daniel House did. Didn't think it was stunning because it's very characteristic of him. And also, as we'd said before the series, I mean, just had a feeling that he could do well in this series, right? And like the reasons Doc Rivers cited for trusting his gut didn't need to necessarily apply, you know, just to game five, right? Like, yeah, he's athletic. Yeah. He's got good size. He can play well with James Harden. You know, all these things have always been true, but Doc Rivers' gut told him game five, and that was correct. I don't think I'd be quite as much on the same page that it was a big boost for House that he had all this time off. I think if anything, it made it a little more difficult for him to play high intensity NBA minutes without,
well, sure, yeah,
absolutely wiped out.
Asking to come out of the game, yeah, sure.
Yeah, he powered through as well as he could. He said, you know, look, these are my brothers. It's a wee season, and when my name is called, I feel like I've, you know, gotta produce in that spot. But I think, honestly, regardless of the circumstances, he is a player. It can give you a jolt, and that can accelerate the pace and look awfully comfortable in transition and make smart, savvy plays as a, you know, screener and roller or popper with James Harden. So, again, last night to me felt like a great performance from the Sixers, perhaps not a performance that they are likely to immediately replicate, but it also did not feel fluky. And I think I'd say that was the case with House's performance as well.
The familiarity with Harden, I think, is pretty huge. And just to have, I mean, you know, for as talented as his team is, they're just not the most athletic team in the world. And when you took Jalen McDaniels out of the mix, which I think was the right decision because he really struggled. But when you do that, you do lose something there with that athleticism and that size. And I think with House, that's, you're making up for it in that regard. And I think the chemistry with Harden is huge. It did make a huge difference. Like you said, when he's screening and you kind of, you know, play like playmaking from the middle of the court, where we've seen D'Anthony Melton do that as well. When you have guys who can do that, it's when you have a perimeter dominant ball dominant player like Harden, and you have a player that's so dominant in Embiid underneath, to have a guy who can just, again, just do that, just be like a connector and play in the middle of the floor and either find the corners, find Joel in the post, find someone else sneaking back door for a let or whatever. I mean, just to have or just, you know, flat out drive to the rim and finish at the rim. He's an athletic player. He can play above the rim. And you saw that on those, you know, multiple drives where it was kind of like you felt like, all right, one of these is not going to go in, and he made every single one. And if he continues to play and find his rhythm, maybe the three ball starts to fall, and then it's that opens up things even more so. So, yeah, I agree. Just a phenomenal button push by Doc that maybe none of us, that even he apparently didn't see coming until he did it. But I'm with you too. Like, it's a guy who like just thrives in chaos and is just, you know, he's been all over the place. His NBA journey, his life journey is wild, and some of the ups and downs of his career. So for him to just kind of step in there, I guess it's not super surprising to see him do well. But at the same time, you need these things, right? I mean, we saw what Lonnie Walker did the other night for the Lakers. I mean, you just need these outlier performances every once in a while where a guy who either hasn't played or has kind of been quiet steps in and gives you really good minutes. That's the way these things tend to go in the playoffs. You need everybody to contribute at some point. And I think, to your point, it was their best team win, I think, I would say probably the entire postseason, where everybody really did play a part. I thought, you know, I know he got in some foul trouble, but I think you could make the argument that might have been Tobias Harris's best playoff game when you look at the context of the opponent, an opponent that he has not generally played well against in a big spot on the road. I know we had some good games last year against Miami, but those were kind of earlier in the series. So, like, I don't know, from a playoff standpoint, that was one of, if not Tobias's best kind of playoff game. And Tyrese Maxey obviously kind of breaking through there, and a team he struggled against all season and in the first four games to break out and have that 30-point performance was also huge. But it all comes back to Joel Embiid, and I thought he was not only the best player on the floor, but I thought he was also like the most assertive player on the floor. And he looked that way from the jump. I know they got off to a little bit of a clunky start. He hits that outrageous step back three on the first possession. But I thought he just looked like that was the most like Joel Embiid he's looked for the four games he's played. I thought that's the most he's looked like him. Coming up with that play on Jaylen Brown, just when you think back to all the stuff he's been through, and look, I mean, he's had some rough moments, and he's had some moments where he's let the injuries affect him. He's let circumstances affect him, and he's kind of, you know, even just going back to last year, and I'm not killing the guy. I mean, the guy had a orbital fracture in his face, had torn ligament in his thumbs. I mean, he was clearly going through a lot. But to see him kind of overcome it in that moment where he has a turnover, doesn't sulk, runs down the other end of the floor, blocks Jaylen Brown. And like, I thought that was the kind of dagger play. And then not only that, hustles back down and gets two free throws. I thought that was kind of the dagger play of the game, where it was like, okay, like that, that's, that probably takes the crowd out of it. That probably silences, you know, the Celtics kind of went into a shell after that and struggled. So when you're looking at the career of Joel Embiid, and I realize they still have one more game that they have to win in the series, and a lot can happen between now and then, but ranking Joel Embiid games, kind of looking at the magnitude and his, you know, the greatness of what he showed, where would you put this as far as Joel Embiid performances when we're talking about postseason and, you know, and in the context of how big the game was for the Sixers?
Maybe I'm not as high on it as you. It doesn't stand out to me as like, this is a contender for number one. I thought he played a great game, but he was like 10 for 23, which is not typical of Joel Embiid.
Like you said, he missed some shots that he normally makes, those mid-range jumpers that he definitely is more prone to make. He did miss a few of those. That is fair.
Yeah, and like the approach and the process and all of that was excellent. And like Boston honestly allowed him and James Harden to be pretty darn comfortable and patient, I think. Like Joel Embiid, you know, thought about a jumper and then declined it. He could just like pass the ball back out to Harden and they could rescreen. And I think Boston perhaps aimed to apply a little more pressure on the ball, but didn't do that very successfully. And then, you know, once James Harden gets the screen from the MVP, the Sixers knew the middle of the floor was really open and that Al Horford was going to stick in that drop coverage. So I think the Sixers exploited that nicely. And I think the thing that felt most, this is a classic Joel Embiid game for me, was, you know, 9 free throws over the second half of the second quarter. I think that was deflating for Boston. And you know, I guess they only went into halftime down 9 points, but you know, to your point about the dagger, like as I said, I just didn't feel like the Celtics had any chance to win that game by early in the second quarter. The Sixers were that good, and Boston was that shaken. So absolutely an impressive play to highlight, right? The effort level and the commitment. I think you don't love the idea of sacrificing his body, right?
Oh,
but
sure. Yeah.
He often can't help himself, and he cares that much about winning and wanting to help his team in those circumstances, which is cool to see. But as I said, I don't think this was a game where the Sixers got like an A++ performance from someone, and that is why they won the way, you know, was the case for James Harden in game one. I think many players played very well, and Joel Embiid was a chief among them, as he often is. And he was, yeah, the best player on the court for the Sixers. But yeah, we look back to that Miami series last year, and the lasting impression for me was game 5 and 6 were collective no-shows. And you have Joel Embiid after game 3 making this comment that perhaps was blown up a bit excessively, depending on where you look, but saying the playoffs are less about adjustments and they're more about players showing up and, you know, doing their jobs at a high level. Joel Embiid has absolutely shown up, you know, in a literal sense, despite yet again having what sounds like a significant, painful, not especially fun injury. And then he has elevated his game, you know, just enough in game 4 for the Sixers to pull that one out in overtime. And in game 5, he was characteristically at the core of an excellent performance. I think for me, now in this situation where they're up 3-2, they're you know, a game away from this historic accomplishment, it just stands out. They started the regular season 12-12. Since that point, they were the NBA's best team. Joel Embiid was the NBA's best player. Again, to the broad theme of this not being entirely random or coincidental or something that we should necessarily be stunned by. He is a great player, even when he is diminished physically. And looks like we're watching a pretty great basketball team right now, albeit one that still needs to prove they can seal the deal. And yeah, we'll see if they're able to accomplish that.
And I think you and I were on kind of the same page all year where, you know, you understood from fans about like, show me in the playoffs, yada, yada, yada. But if it didn't, it felt like a different team. And I know that's been kind of Doc Rivers' message, and it's a fair message of like, this team is not last year's team. They're not the year before. Like, this is this year's team. A lot of these guys are new. They weren't here. Some of these guys, like they don't care about, oh, the Sixers have never made it out of the second round. Like, I'm sure it's in the back of Joel Embiid's mind. Like, I'm sure it is, because he's a human being and he knows he hasn't made it out of the second round. So I'm sure it's there. I'm sure a guy like Tobias Harris, same. I'm sure it's there in the back of his mind. But I think all along you and I have felt like, hey, this team's pretty good. And like, they have some reasons why it made sense that they might get to this point, that they might be able to beat a very good Celtics team, and why this, I mean, I said going into the series, you know, outside of Joel Embiid's injury, obviously that was a huge factor, but I thought these teams were a lot more evenly matched than maybe some people outside thought, because like what you just said, from, you know, since they were 12-12, they had the best record in the NBA from then. And that with the most difficult schedule in the NBA coming out of the All-Star break. And I thought they played their best basketball during that, which is saying a lot. And like you said, best player, they had the MVP. They had the best player in the NBA. They had James Harden, who I think probably should have been an All-Star. The All-NBA thing was tough, because the guard situation was insane. When you look at the guys who made the All-NBA team, and it's just a really loaded group of really, really talented players. But yeah, I think this team was maybe better than the outside perception, and maybe even the inside perception of some fans who, again, were kind of in that show me in the playoffs mode. And again, still have some work to do. Still a very big game Thursday night that they have to win if they want to advance. Could they win a game seven in Boston? Perhaps, yes. But you probably don't want to go there. It will probably behoove them to take care of business Thursday night and close it out at the Wells Fargo Center. I'm sure the crowd will be pretty intense. I'm sure it's going to be a pretty wild atmosphere. But Noah, please let everyone know where they can find your work and where they can find you on social media, Twitter, et cetera.
Noah Levick, N-O-A-H, on Twitter, just the name. And you can find my stories over at NBC Sports Philadelphia. com, and I think that's the gist of it. Nothing too complicated there.
A straightforward guy, and that's perfectly encompasses your personality. No, but I appreciate you so much. Always a great time to talk to you, and it's always I always feel like when you and I talk, I rethink some things and I gain a little bit of knowledge from time to time. So I always appreciate it when you hop on and when we talk when we're not on the podcast. So appreciate you as always. And we appreciate everyone for tuning in to the Coming In for a Landing podcast. Please rate, subscribe, download wherever you get your podcasts. I am your host, Paul Hudrick, and I will talk to you next time.